It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The presidential election is about 9 weeks away, and the process of how Pennsylvanians will cast their ballots and how they are processed remains up in the air and maybe up to the courts. Republican Jake Corman is the Senate Majority Leader and, along with Senate President Pro Tem Joe Scarnati, has introduced legislation that they say will expand voter access. Senator Corman, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Senator, you have said, quote, "it doesn't matter what the process is for casting a ballot if the results are in question," end quote. Yet there are a few lawsuits against the Commonwealth, including one by the national leader of the Republican Party, President Trump, who has spread some misinformation about mail-in ballots and the very results of the upcoming election. Are you confident in the reliability of the vote-by-mail process in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, it's much better than other states. You just can't send ballots out to people. In Pennsylvania, the person has to apply for an absentee ballot, and then once they apply for the absentee ballot, the ballot will be sent to them, and then they can then cast it through the mail. So it's a much better process than some of the other states have where they're just sending out ballots to people. So
right.
I am confident in Pennsylvania that we have a good system.
Yet the president's campaign is suing Pennsylvania and their process.
Well, it's over the drop boxes. That's one issue,
right,
which is an important issue because the counties have made that up. When we passed an expansion of the mail of the absentee ballot process, and before you had to have an excuse to do an absentee ballot. Now you don't have to. So that's all we really changed in the law in Pennsylvania. But the counties expecting a lot larger absentee ballots by mail started these drop boxes. And there's no authorization for them to do that in the law. So we're trying to, the president has now filed a suit against that, and we're concerned about the security of drop boxes. So that's what the president's suing about. So those are valid concerns, and I understand that. That's why we're trying to pass a bill to take care of a lot of these issues so we can address some of the county concerns, but do it in a way that makes it secure and allows people to be able to cast their ballots and again, be confident in the result.
So how does your legislation address the idea of drop-off locations? How does the bill address that?
It would allow a couple other locations that they could have them dropped off. We're trying to adhere it, but again, it's important you cast your ballot, whether you mail it in or whether you drop it off somewhere, that it's a secure system. Mm-hmm. And so we do allow a couple alternative locations, but not just anywhere that doesn't have security.
Do you offer suggestions of where these secure locations could be? Libraries, what?
No, they're the county courthouse, your voting precinct where you vote. That's the only alternative locations we offer in the legislation.
County elections officials cannot start processing, known as pre-canvassing, mailed-in ballots until 8 o'clock the morning of the election. Your legislation would allow counties up to 3 days prior to the election to begin. Governor Wolf and others have wanted 3 weeks. Why not get an earlier start to the process?
We don't want all the pre-canvassing going on. We don't want counts going out, where people are telling people, hey, we're short on this municipality. Hey, we need more votes here. We want it to be election day voting. And so by giving them 3 days, I think we give them ample opportunity to open the ballots, flatten them out, and be ready to process them, but don't count them. Hopefully it will alleviate all the time it'll take to count all the absentee ballots because we'll have a lot more than we've ever had before.
1.5 million ballots were cast by mail, and only three counties completed the tabulation of those ballots the day after the primary. And it took nearly 3 weeks for all 67 counties to complete that task. Are you okay with the counting taking days and might not know the results for days after the actual election?
Well, we hope they don't. Hopefully it will not take the time it did in the primary because that was the first time. People know they need more manpower. Again, I think getting election results as soon as possible is important.
Under your legislation, the deadline to request a mail-in ballot would be 15 days prior to the election. The governor said he opposes that because it moves up the deadline by 8 days. What's the reasoning for the 15 days?
It was a concern of the post office to be able to process all this mail. because right now our state law says you have to have the ballot there by 8 p.m. on election night. So we want all the ballots to be there that people cast. So by moving the dates back, then you got to get, you know, we'll publicize this, we'll get it out to people so they know that. So this will give them the opportunity to get the ballot earlier and get the ballot in earlier.
So Act 77, which allowed for the no-excuse mail-in ballots, was definitely a bipartisan effort last year. Do you expect the same cooperation for your legislation this time?
We are hopeful. We're certainly reaching out to the governor. We understand that the governor has to sign it, so there's no sense doing all this if the governor's not going to sign it. We're trying to improve the process so that, again, everyone has access to voting, that everyone has confidence and security of the voting, and then we get the results in a timely fashion. So we're working with the governor. We've reached out on numerous occasions. We'll continue to reach out to the governor. Hopefully he'll reach back and negotiate, but they may decide that they have a better chance with their friends in the courts than they do with Republicans in the legislature, which is unfortunate because, you know, the purview of elections is done through the legislature, signed by the governor.
Jake Corman is the Pennsylvania Senate Majority Leader. Senator, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Take care.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. State troopers on Pennsylvania highways commonly use traffic stops in hopes of stopping the flow of illegal drugs into the Commonwealth. A new report by the Newsroom Collaborative Spotlight PA and The Appeal indicates many of the stops and searches are conducted illegally and eventually get thrown out of court. David Harris is a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh and WESA's legal analyst. David, are the stops legal? Doesn't the law just require the officer, the trooper, to have a mere suspicion of a crime, you know, a vehicle or a traffic violation?
Well, that's right, Kevin. What we see here is the use of traffic offenses as pretexts in order to stop people to search for evidence of crimes of which there is no evidence. The Supreme Court has said anytime a police officer sees a driver commit a traffic offense, that's full probable cause to pull the driver over and do the things you do in a traffic stop. It doesn't necessarily allow a search, but it starts this process in a completely legal way.
So officers can't search a vehicle for drugs or other illegal items. So how do they get more information without physically doing a search?
So in order to do more, they look in the car. They're entitled to look through the windows to see if they see any evidence of a crime having been committed. And sometimes they may see paraphernalia. They may smell a burning marijuana smell. But when those things are not there, and they often are not, the officer will begin questioning the people in the car, not just the driver, but the other people too, to see if there are inconsistencies, to observe their behavior and see if they might seem nervous to him, or even ask the driver if the driver will consent to a search.
Are they allowed to, these units, have drug-sniffing dogs with them, even for a traffic stop?
One of the ways this works is, like I said, a police officer will say, well, okay, can I search your car? Now, assume that the citizen says no, and a person has every right to say no, and the fact that they say no doesn't make them suspicious under the law. So what police departments have done as a countermove is to have drug-sniffing dogs available, either right on the scene in the officer's car or vehicle, or being able to call another unit that has a drug-sniffing canine. The Supreme Court has ruled that a drug-sniffing dog used on a car is in fact not a search that engages the gears of the Fourth Amendment, as long as you get the dog to the vehicle during the time of a regular traffic stop.
Well, who determines what's the normal length of time for a traffic stop?
The Fourth Amendment contains a rule of reasonableness. You cannot be subject to unreasonable searches and seizures. So there's no hard and fast rule like exactly 25 minutes or 30 minutes. But we all know that those procedures, checking your license and your registration and insurance and so forth, that sort of thing takes 25, 30, 35 minutes.
Is there any sense of a success rate? You know, troopers pulling over a motorist for
a legitimate reason, but actually finding evidence of something more serious, say the transporting of illegal drugs.
One of the things, Kevin, that I found most disturbing in reviewing the records for this series was that the state police don't keep any data on these searches that would allow you to determine how often they actually succeed. There's a comment in the Spotlight PA piece from one of the Pennsylvania State Police spokespeople who says, well, we often find drugs or whatever, other contraband. Well, how often? And what's the nature of that contraband? In general, success rates in the best interdiction programs, and I just mean that in the sense of most successful, are not finding anything more than, say, 10 or 15% of cars at most might be carrying anything at all.
You reviewed some of the records. So what's your overall takeaway from what you saw?
Well, there are lots and lots of cases in which there's a very general statement like, I saw signs of criminal activity and therefore I did this. To me, that kind of boilerplate language in case after case after case with no specifics is a sign that they saw nothing and that nothing justified the search. And prosecutors should be throwing those out.
For years, state police actually did keep data regarding a person's race in their records of traffic stops, but then they ceased doing that. We talked last year about this when state police said they would resume recording that information. Any idea whether they have indeed done so?
I saw nothing in the piece that indicated that they have resumed doing that. And that's a major problem. I mean, when you have a law enforcement agency that covers a whole state, when they're engaging in practices that may, and I say may, implicate racial profiling or misuse of law enforcement power or lack of probable cause, you need to be able to tell the public if that's happening or not. It is not sufficient to simply say, we think we're doing a great job, trust us.
There have long been concerns that racial profiling has been used for traffic stops, in suspected drug cases in particular. But if there aren't any stats from the state police, how can we tell if people of color are being targeted?
Well, we can't. And that's a real problem. That's a real problem. And we, the public, are not in a position to say you are definitely targeting people of color. But they, the state police, are not in a position to say, no, we're not. Without the data, we're in a stalemate of suspicion, perhaps. And that's not good. We need to be able to know what the answer is there so that we can trust our law enforcement folks and go forward knowing that they're doing things the right way. But it's simply no longer acceptable to say, no, trust us, we're doing it right. We have to be able to actually see it. Even if they're not required to do it under the law, they should do it because they want the trust of the public.
David Harris is WESA's legal analyst, a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, and he is the host of the Criminal and Justice Podcast. Thanks, David.
A pleasure, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pollution levels in American cities have fallen in the decades since the passage of clean air laws in the 1970s. And even though cars and factories are emitting less, some types of air pollution might increase in the years to come. The reason? Climate change. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
One day this spring, after nearly 15 years without one, 29-year-old David Machuk got an unexpected visitor, an asthma attack.
You forget how bad they are. They teach you in some of the asthma education classes to breathe through a straw and pinch your nose, that it's kind of mimics having an asthma attack, but it's so much worse than I remembered.
Machuk grew up near Johnstown and lives in the Pittsburgh suburb of Forest Hills. He called a doctor and got medicine to control his symptoms, but this summer, particularly on hot days, breathing has been difficult.
I walk out of my house and it's like you just walk into this wall of heat and humidity and it knocks the breath out of you.
Machuk, who's hoping to enter nursing school in the fall, says he'd like to go hiking with his friends, but has for the most part stayed inside because of his breathing problems in the heat.
I like to walk and do a lot of things outdoors, and it's just been a struggle because I feel like I'm constantly trying to catch my breath.
One reason why it might be hard for him and others with asthma to breathe: hot days produce a type of air pollution called ozone, or smog. Deb Gentile is Michuk's doctor and an allergy and asthma specialist. She says ozone is an irritant inside the lungs and can trigger or worsen asthma attacks.
Basically, it can cause airway inflammation or swelling, tightening of the breathing tubes, so it's very difficult to move air in and out. A patient can cough, gasp, just have difficulty breathing.
Gentile says she's had plenty of patients this summer with breathing problems during what would normally be a quiet period between allergy seasons. This coincides with a spike in bad air quality days. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection has had nearly the same number of air quality action days already this year as it had all of 2019. The agency says that's because it's been a hot summer. July was almost 5 degrees hotter than normal in Pittsburgh, according to the National Weather Service. And heat is perfect for creating ozone. Ted Russell is an atmospheric chemist at Georgia Tech.
Ozone is a tricky molecule. It is formed in the atmosphere. It's not emitted directly.
Ozone is formed by two types of pollution: volatile organic compounds emitted by things like paint and gasoline fumes, and nitrogen oxides created by fossil fuel combustion in cars, factories, and power plants. You also need sunlight to create ozone. Heat waves, which have been on the increase in the U.S., can speed up the process, Russell says. One reason why is gasoline and other volatile materials will evaporate pollutants into the atmosphere faster on hot days.
Just like water evaporates faster, but gasoline even faster still. And paints, on a hot day, they dry fast.
Regulations have led to fewer emissions and thus decreases in ozone around the U.S., says Edson Severnini, an environmental economist at Carnegie Mellon University.
We have made a lot of progress. Like, it's, you see the graphs and you feel like, oh my God, something is, you know, something good has happened.
But that progress could be upended by climate change, he says. Severnini says ozone starts to really spike above 30 degrees Celsius, or 86 degrees Fahrenheit. He says we've already seen the number of hot days increase since 1980, and the number of days when cities in the U.S. reach 86 degrees is expected to double by 2050 because of climate change.
So you can imagine that by mid-century, which is like not far from now, you know, you're going to have very large levels.
To make matters worse, cities around the world are growing, supercharging the creation of ozone through the urban heat island effect, says Chandana Mitra, a geoscientist at Auburn University. During heat waves, concrete-packed cities can be 10 to 15 degrees hotter than their surrounding countrysides.
So more heat, more human activity, more growth in urban areas equals more ozone being created.
There's a way to limit climate change and the heat it brings, Mitra says, but it's not going to be easy. Lower our greenhouse gas emissions. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joe Yazenkovic, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.